Welcome to Get Over It, the Consciousness Transforming Podcast for Exceptional 21st Century Living. We have a very interesting show today. We're going to be speaking with Hirsch Wilson, and his book is Firefighter Zen, a field guide to thriving in tough times. And we definitely need this right now. But it's interesting because his book is based on his years of firefighting, but there are lessons that we can learn and glean positive hope from for today. So sit back and listen, and then go get the book, because you'll enjoy it. It's an easy read, very pleasant read. We can do it in a day and a half if you're a slow reader. Now, the information shared on Get Over It uses intuitive and pragmatic insight to help you shift your consciousness to break through blocks and release energy that is no longer needed. Yes, we're going to help you release the BS that is holding you back. But you guys know I always ask that question, are you truly at the subconscious level ready to? And by the way, folks, BS is belief system. Now, a bit about me for my new listeners, intuitive since birth. I'm a third generation intuitive with over 3 decades of experience supporting people to break through the blocks along their path. I'm a strategist for personal and professional transformation, revealing cutting edge information that enables you to prosper and thrive. I spent 25 successful years in corporate America as an executive sales professional, and I am the founder of Healing Visions Ministries and the Northern California Children's Education Network, a 501c3 nonprofit. I also authored 2 books. Excuse me. I provide consultations and healings in all areas of life that heal the mind, body, spirit connection, allowing you to live your very best life. My clients tell me that I keep it real while providing them with accurate information to assist them along their journey as a spirit living a human existence. But they also say, if you really don't want to know, don't ask Monique. My background includes a doctorate in metaphysics, Reiki master teacher, ordained minister, and clinical hypnotherapist. So whether you are stressed, depressed, or possessed, I can help. To find out more about me and the services I offer, go to my website, and that's MoniqueChapman.com, and I invite you to like me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter and LinkedIn. Hirsch Wilson and his wife, Lori, became volunteer firefighters in 1986. He has worked as an organizational consultant, pilot, outdoor adventure trainer, professional dancer, and author. He writes for Backdraft Magazine and other publications, and he lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and you can check him out at his website, and that's HirschWilson.com, HirschWilson.com. Welcome, Hirsch.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Hey, it's great to have you. You know, the title of your book, Firefighter Zen, when most people look at it, they're like, okay, well, that doesn't make any sense, firefighter and Zen. But to me, immediately it kind of made sense, because a firefighter has to be very focused with what they're doing. And then I actually initiated a Zen master into Reiki, and he was extremely focused. So talk to us about that. What is the connection between firefighting and Zen?
That's a great question to begin with. I think of Zen and firefighting as two different roads to the same conclusions and the same consequences. Firefighting teaches you some very basic principles that are Zen-like. You know, one is that our time here is short. We do not have much time. Buddha said that the greatest mistake we make is believing we have time. In the same vein, that what firefighting teaches you is, because, you know, we're responding to crisis and tragedy and emergencies all the time, mm-hmm. is that all we have is this moment. The past is not worth worrying about because it's gone, and the future is unpredictable, especially now. And all we really have is this moment. So I've learned to sit in my kitchen and look out at our red garden gate and really appreciate this moment in time. I think next is that we learn that our greatest adventure and purpose and cause in life is to help alleviate the suffering of others, to serve others. And mm-hmm. and that is how, you know, that is why we're here. That's why we're here on this planet. And then finally, I think the work of firefighting, as you mentioned, in the middle of a fire or in the middle of a cardiac arrest, it's an extremely focusing experience. You are there, present in the moment, serving and helping others, and all everything else goes away. So you learn to be extraordinarily focused.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of where Zen and firefighting parallel.
Okay. Well, you know, a lot of people, when you say the word firefighter, they say, okay, the guys hang out at the fire station. You know, they might have a 24-hour or 48-hour shift, whatever. And they just eat this fabulous food because you always hear about the firefighter chili cook-offs and all
Absolutely.
Of that.
Right.
And that then they just go when there's a call, and they go and they handle it and they come back. But when your phone, in quotes, rings, you're going most of the time to a freaking disaster. So how do you deal with that? I mean, you're dealing with the, I don't know, it's negative, or I should say the lower vibrational frequencies that happen in life?
Yeah, I think what, you know, as volunteers, which is a little different than a career firefighter, mm-hmm. is that we're on 24/7. So we're always on duty. So you have your normal life, and then you have your firefighter life. And you can switch to your firefighter life in an instant at any time during the day or night.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is you learn how to turn on the switch, right? You learn how to go from being a dad to being a firefighter really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other difference is the background noise of a firefighter's life, that what, you know, it's kind of the self-narrative that's always going on, is that there's tragedy happening, there's stuff going on. We're incredibly aware and acutely aware and hyper-aware of things that can go wrong and the kind of calls we're going on. So that kind of changes the kind of narrative in your life, if you will. And I think you have to kind of keep that compartmentalized, because if it gets too out of control, you can become an anxious and, you know, overly anxious person that's not a whole lot of fun to be with. but at the same time, the background noise of a firefighter is quite different than the background noise of civilians.
Yeah, but it just seems like the average civilian has a lot of difficulty accepting that sometimes stuff just happens, okay? But it seems like the firefighter has been able to kind of integrate that into their lifestyle and,
absolutely.
And move on from it. I mean, if you go to a horrific fire, I live not too far from Oakland, California, where several years ago there was the warehouse fire where so many young, talented musicians perished. And, I mean, that must have been horrific for those folks to go to. So if you're experiencing something like that, how do you move past it? Because the average person would just hang on and say, oh, the poor kids died and I don't know what to do with, and be in mourning like forever. But you have to go and take care of that and then still have a normal life.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things. So first of all, I come from a position, because my wife always accuses me sometimes of being, Lori, of being a little too dark. But my view of the universe is that it is often a dark and chaotic place. And we have to, and if you want to live with no illusions, you have to accept that. And it's only when we accept that and live without illusions, and some of the illusions we carry are, I'm going to live forever, that life is about happiness, that nothing bad will ever happen to me. And those are all illusions that kind of stop us from deeply understanding what life is about and deeply understanding how you find joy in your life.
Mm-hmm.
So, as a firefighter, it's not that you become attenuated to bad things happening. It's that you incorporate that stuff into your being, and that allows you to understand at a deep level what life is about and really understand what joy is about. So we go to a bad call, And I think the difference is most people don't believe stuff that they believe that they have a life plan and their life plan is going to work out, right? They
uh-huh.
have they put affirmations on their bathroom mirror. They have their calendar all laid out. But it's like if you go back right now, to go back to March when all of a sudden the pandemic
uh-huh.
hit and
uh-huh.
everybody just realized the calendar they had laid out for the year was worthless, that none of that was going to happen. And that's how firefighters approach life. We know that stuff can happen at any moment.
Mm-hmm.
We know that bad things and good things can the mantra of the fire department world is stuff happens, right? And we're
mm-hmm.
used to that. So we're not shocked when something bad happens. We still suffer, we grieve when something bad happens, but we're not shocked by the fact that stuff happens. And that's a significant change in a mental outlook. Understanding that life is precarious, life is fragile, that your life plan can get tossed in a day, and it's the old story that life turns on the dime. So that's incorporated into the mentality and the emotions of firefighters.
Well, it must have been very interesting to learn, you know, to deal with that. Is there a lot of mental illness within the firefighting community? Because at some point you just can't cope anymore, even though you have
absolutely.
Some tools?
Yeah, I think right now in the firefighter world, firefighters are much more likely to die by suicide than they are what we call a line of duty death in a fire or something like that. And so we have a dangerous rate of suicide. We have a lot of PTSD and we're just coming to grips with that. I mean, it's like 2020, guys. Let's wake up and realize that we're emotional beings and we're affected by the work we do.
Uh-huh.
And of course the image of a firefighter, and I would say this, and this carries over as a stereotype into not only men but a lot of women, that we're supposed to be tough, we're supposed to not let our feelings affect us, right?
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. That we're supposed to suck it up, and I think that's nonsense. It doesn't work. and
well,
I
not long term anyway.
Not long term, and I think this has been written about, but one of the effects of what we're going through now, the pandemic, the recession, mm-hmm. the search for racial justice, it's going to have an effect, a mental and emotional effect on a lot of people long term.
Yeah.
Because we're just not, go ahead.
No, go ahead, please. Finish.
I think we're, maybe as a nation, we're just not a very emotionally mature. We're going through kind of a wake-up call
uh-huh.
in terms of being able to cope with the fact that life is difficult right now. And I think that's going to have an effect on a lot of people.
Mm. Well, you brought up a few things that I'd like to talk about, and you write about in your blog,
sure.
On your website, hirschwilson.com. And the first thing I want to talk about is something that caught my attention right away, and it's a meditation on race for
mm-hmm.
us white folks. And then you have a Black Lives Matter, you know, the sign and all of that there. So talk to us about that, because you have a very unique perspective on all of this coming from a Republican background and being from Minnesota. So talk to us about this, please, your thoughts.
Sure. So I get really emotional about this because it's so frustrating. But to me, racism in the country is not about skin color. It's about power, who has it and who doesn't. Right.
Mm-hmm.
It is a white problem. And the more you kind of look at things, and what drives me insane, is, like the example of teaching history,
mm-hmm.
who teaches it and what they teach is a political act, right?
Yes.
It's a political act. And what is left out is a political act. It's a conscious decision. So we were taught white history. We were taught as if African Americans didn't exist, as if indigenous people did not exist. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to the 17th century and the first slave ships that arrived. And when you understand and start reading the true history of this country, I never was taught about Tulsa in 1920, right? Mm-hmm. Or I was never taught about the riots in Arkansas in mm-hmm. the 30s. None of that exists, right? It doesn't exist. It's just wiped out from history. So, mm-hmm. so in my kind of sense of things is when you grow up in a society that's essentially racist, whether you're white or black, it affects you. It is hard to understand. It's like that story of a fish in the water, and we don't know who discovered water, but we're pretty sure it wasn't a fish. Mm-hmm. We live in such a structurally and systemic racist country that we're not even aware of it, right? We're not even aware of it. And it takes something like, I grew up in the 60s in Minneapolis. I had incredible parents who were, for their time, extremely aware of the racism in the country. But I remember in 1968, and I thought the world's falling apart when Dr. King was assassinated, and Bobby King and Bobby mm-hmm. Kennedy was assassinated, and the riots mm-hmm. in the cities, and I thought the world's falling apart. But then watching what happened to George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, but especially the expression on that police officer's face who was kneeling on George Floyd's neck, and that expression on his face was, this is just a normal day of being a police officer, right? And it was like, what's the problem, right? He's killing a black man on television, essentially. And mm-hmm. it's like, yes, this is just my normal day. And it was just that one of those shocking moments that just, again, awakes you to the systemic racism in our system, right? In our minds and in the culture. And again, I had that same feeling of the earth shaking beneath my feet. You know what I mean? And then the whole thing with Breonna, because she was an EMT, right? She's like mm-hmm. me, and they break into her house without a warrant, shoot her 8 times, and that happened months ago, and one officer was fired, but nothing else has happened. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah, and that officer will probably get a job at another department.
Of course.
Well, you know, you say, you know, of course you do, but, you know, I don't necessarily always have those of courses, and it is interesting because I was talking to my husband the other day, and we're from completely different backgrounds. I'm from Gilderland, which mm-hmm. is very much upper class bedroom community. He's from downtown Albany, which is very much the ghetto, and, you know, it's amazing that we come together sometimes. But being a black woman, I sometimes have those thoughts that you were just speaking of, because I was not indoctrinated into the black community. My parents didn't have us around relatives. My father was this very strong West Indian whose family came to America, and you're going to fit into the white world, you know. So a lot of mm-hmm. what you're talking about, I'm like, okay, excuse me, I saw that growing up, and no, I didn't like it, but didn't know what to do with it. And you know, you talked earlier about the history, and I have to share this because I thought it was the most comical thing. I think it was fifth grade when we do the Mayflower thing, you know, the your lineage, your ancestors, and all of that, and where they come from and how they came over in the Mayflower. And I was sitting there trying to do my homework, and I was dumbfounded, and I wouldn't talk to my father about it. So what I did was I wrote down My family was on the bottom of the Mayflower rowing it here for all of y'all. The teacher didn't appreciate that, but that exercise never came up again in class for years, as far as I know.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's interesting how you have your lens, if you will, and you just speak to that lens. But on the blog, you also say white privilege is real and apparent. Talk to us about that, because a lot of people don't believe that. And again, you're coming from a Republican background, and I keep stressing that, folks, because you guys know I'm Democratic, and I tell people to vote for whomever, you know, tugs their heartstrings. But I'd like to, you know, get a different perspective. So talk to us about white privilege and how real it is and how very apparent it is.
Sure. So first of all, it's to clear the record. I started out as Republican, and my dad, he worked for the Republican Party. But two things happened. The Republican Party left us, and we just shifted. We're so far into the Democratic. We're so radically Democratic now. It's pretty cool. But to me, it's so obvious. So for me, I am the oldest white son of a highly successful entrepreneur, right? And I'm the oldest of six kids, right? So doors, and the thing is that you're oblivious. The reason that there's two reasons why people don't like to talk about white privilege. First is you're oblivious to it. Things just happen for you, right? You get into colleges, you're invited into clubs, you can date people, right? Mm-hmm. And it just happens naturally without any problems. I grew up in theater, and I was a dancer, and I remember having one of my best friends was Lewis Whitlock, who was a black dancer. We lived together, and we were great friends. But he had to tell me about all the times that he was rejected. He couldn't get jobs. When he got a job, he would they would just treat him horribly. And it was like this kind of wake up call, because we were exactly the same. We were the same age, had the same background, right? And listening to what to Lewis's experiences and comparing to mine was like, huh, that's weird, right? Mm-hmm. And then as you get older, it just becomes clear that when you're white and when you're the oldest son, right, things just are easy. Does that make sense? They just come easily.
Yeah.
And then you have to take a step back, and I think that comes with maturity and a kind of curiosity to say, wait a minute, this is not an even playing field, right? This is not an even playing field. And I think about my family, which is half, we have a lot of African Americans in my family, and I think about just simple things like my brother-in-law, who I love dearly. He's the same age as I am, and in 1968, when we were both draft age, right? And I was terrified about the draft, and he was just, what's the word I want to use? He just kind of like knew he was going to be drafted. So he was driving into Newark at the time that Newark was in flames, right? Mm-hmm. And he just assumed that he was a black man, a black 19-year-old, and that's what the war wanted. They wanted, black kids to go over and fight Vietnam and be cannon fodder. And because he couldn't get into Newark because of the riots, he turned around, and fortunately got a phone call from a coach of a football team, a college in Missouri, and they invited him to play for them, so he avoided the draft. But what George went through compared to what I went through, it just became apparent that there are two different universes, right? And I can't not look around and see the same things play out in subtle ways, right? Mm-hmm. I dress how I want to dress. I'm real casual about things. I've never had to give my kids the speech about about being careful, right? Mm-hmm. When you get stopped by the police, I never had to worry about my daughters being pulled over by police. But George and his kids, you know, they live in Minneapolis. He's got a 30-year-old son. He's got two daughters. My sister had to give him the talk, right? Give him the talk. It's like, here's what you do when you get pulled over by the police, which you will, because it's Minneapolis and it's a racist city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is any place. Yes.
But so that all that stuff goes probably unknown by most white people, and so you have to be black to understand it. Does that make sense? To understand what it's like to be to not have the power, right? Mm-hmm. And I think Dr. King said it in his letters from the Birmingham jail. It's like, power isn't given to you. Power is something you have to take, right? And that is true of civil rights movement. It's true of suffragist movement, right? Power isn't given away. Power is something you have to take. And I think that is right now, it's back on the table of discussion. And people, I mean, white people who don't know their history, just have no clue.
Mm-hmm.
Just have no clue, because they can't see the world. You have to see the world. It's like you have to go into the world. You have to travel the world. You have to live in other cultures, right? In order to understand what our culture is. In order to go, my view, right, is just one view of thousands of other views. And until you can do that and accept that and see it that way, you're gonna miss it.
And you know, it's your view, and you're entitled to your view, and it doesn't necessarily mean that your view is the view, you know. And I think
that's
kind of where we got off track a little bit. Now, in your book, you talk about emergencies and problems and inconveniences, and how to see them very differently. So right now, between the uprising going on in the States and the virus, and we'll talk more about the virus in a moment, we do have emergencies, problems, and inconveniences. So how can we see our present situation in a more positive light, or take action for a more positive light, in your view?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I'm sorry for getting on my soapbox. Anyways,
you can be your soapbox as long as you want.
I think the reality of the firefighter world, which helps answer this question, is that 90% of the calls we go on, in our eyes, as firefighters and first responders, are not emergencies, right?
Mm-hmm.
No one's dying. There's not a life threat. There's not a house burning down. So when we go to call, and most of this is simply because we see a lot of calls. We see lots and lots and lots of calls, lots of 911 calls. So we're really good at distinguishing between what's an emergency and what is not an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
And so the term I use, which is my mantra, and is that if it's not an emergency, what is it? It might be a problem, or 80% of the time, it's not an emergency, not a problem. It's simply an inconvenience.
Mm-hmm.
And the example I use in the real world is you're driving to work in the morning, you're stuck in traffic, you're going to be late, and our brain takes over and goes like this. I'm going to be late. My boss is going to be angry at me for being late for a meeting. He or she's going to give me a negative review. Oh, my God. She might fire me. If she fires me, I'm going to go home. My husband's going to divorce me, right? I'm going to end up on the streets, and I will starve to death, right? And that's that quick self-talk narrative that goes through our brain. And so you see this on the highways. You see that everywhere. Our people start getting upset over things that are not a life threat. No one's going to die, right? No house is burning down. But they act as if it is.
Mm-hmm.
So I use this mantra. The mantra, it's like, is this an emergency or is this an inconvenience? If I can tell myself that this is an inconvenience, a couple of things happen in my brain. One, I don't get ramped up. I don't get over excited. I don't get angry. And as a result, I'm calmer and I can solve the problem, whatever the problem. I'm much more creative. On the fire service, we use this all the time. We go to a call, and as soon as that, you know, we're it's like Pavlov's dogs. When that pager goes off, we get ramped up right away.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to learn to manage our self-talk. We have to learn to say, is this a true emergency? A true emergency for us might be a cardiac arrest in a child, right? And so mm-hmm. we're going to get ramped up. We're going to go fast. We're going to do whatever we have to do. We're going to bust through traffic, all those kinds of things, because that's a true emergency. But if it comes out, the call comes out, which we get all the time, a 55-year-old man falls. Well, I'm not going to get ramped up about that. I'm going to go do my job. I'm going to stay calm. I'm going to solve the problem. So continually saying and using the mantra, this is not an emergency, this is simply an inconvenience, is a really important mind shift, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you take what we're going through now, this global pandemic, mm-hmm. right, it's extremely stressful. When you look at the headlines, right, I get that. But I think what you have to do then is talk to yourself at a more personal level, right? Some of us are definitely going through emergencies. We've lost our jobs, right? Somebody might be sick. Those kinds of things are emergencies, and they're significant problems. But a lot of us are getting ramped up. But when you look at it, things are not that bad. Okay, we're stuck at home. Is that an emergency or is that an inconvenience? We're not being able to see our friends. Is that an emergency or is that an inconvenience? A lot of the stuff we're experiencing today isn't necessarily an emergency. It's an inconvenience,
mm-hmm.
right? And I compare it to my grandparents, who were both born in 1900.
Mm-hmm.
So they went through the First World War, the flu epidemic, the Great Depression, Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
They went through Vietnam, the civil rights stuff. They went through all those things, right? And
mm-hmm.
so if you say, I'm going to compare where I am right now to what they went through, oh, I get it. I keep my perspective. This is more of an inconvenience right now for a lot of us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not to take away the fact that for a lot of people right now, this is a tragedy. This is really a horrible, horrible experience. But for a lot of us, there's just a lot of inconvenience and not emergency in what we're going through.
Okay, so we have the emergency and the problem and the inconvenience, but I want to talk about the problem right now, because with the virus
sure.
that's running rampant here in the United States, much higher than every place else in the world, and we're supposed to be the number one fix it. We're supposed to be the strongest country in the world. We're supposed to be the most technically advanced. You know, you go down
yep.
the laundry list, and now
yep.
we have this orange thing in the White House, and we are in deep doo-doo. So how can we utilize your principles and – first of all, get out of deep doo-doo. Just let's talk about the virus. Let's put the racial stuff aside. I mean, you
sure.
know, when it first came out, you couldn't even get tested, and now the tests are wishy-washy. They may work. They may not work. We're pushing for babies go back to school, and I understand the value of education and socializing, okay? But is this truly the right time? So could you address some of that?
Absolutely. I mean, everybody has an opinion, right? Everybody
mm-hmm.
has become,
yeah.
over the last couple of months, an epidemiologist.
Yeah.
My daughter's an ICU doctor, so I have
mm-hmm.
her to go to get actual facts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you said is right. I mean, I think someone said it's that the pandemic has magnified the cracks and faults in this country, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm extremely patriotic. I love the idea, I mean, Jefferson's idea of the great experiment and all that, but we have been exposed. And I think to me, it comes down to the simple division between being the power or the myth of the individual,
mm-hmm.
and the need to be part of a community, right? And that we have to act together in each other's best interests. And I think the mask thing is a great example of that. I don't wear a mask to protect me from you. I wear a mask to protect you, right? If I'm positive. And I can't believe that we have this divisiveness and people objecting to wearing a mask. We wear a mask to protect each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the thing that's really has divided us. But and I think the myth is, if you look at our history, every great thing we've done comes from us working as a collective,
mm-hmm.
working together. Whether it was after 9/11, the Second World War, and you can go on and on and on and on. When we work as a collective, when we work together, we get things done. But this idea of that we need to put the individual on a pedestal and I get to do whatever I want all the time, no matter what people say, is destructive, and it's a myth. It's like the idea of the Lone Ranger. The Lone Ranger is a myth. It's mm-hmm. a cartoon character. It's not how great societies work. So you know, my kind of, I'm like a lot of people, I'm just incredibly frustrated by how we've blown the opportunity to control the pandemic,
mm-hmm.
How it's going to get worse, and the only way we're going to get back, you know, I don't want to go back to normal. I want to go back to something new and different and better. But the only way we get there is by controlling the pandemic first, and doing what the most powerful, richest country in the world, right, should be mm-hmm. able to do, and do as well as the European Union or as well as what they're doing in Southeast Asia. It's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm going to ask a really weird question, and it just came to my mind. So
go for it.
The crudeness of it, but do you think that on some level the powers that be right now are allowing the COVID-19 to run rampant, to kind of do a cleansing of sorts? I mean, who's catching the virus? Old folks, which they don't care about. There was some senator that said, oh, if you're over 70, you can just die and give it to the young people.
Right.
Is running rampant in the Hispanic and Black communities.
Yep. The minorities.
Is it a way of culling the herd?
You know, I don't know. I think in my darkest moments, I think this. I think that the GOP is thinking, we're just going to pretend this isn't happening, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to accept hundreds of thousands of deaths in order to keep the stock market up, right? And they're not mm-hmm. going to say that, but I think underneath. And I remember reading an article, a letter to the editor in our paper, and it basically said that. It said, listen, this is just, the only people who are dying are people over 70, right? So, you know, they only have they have one foot in the grave anyways. I think the fact that this is affecting minorities at a much higher rate is really, I mean, I think that's an untouchable question for people. But it mm-hmm. certainly makes you think. Because what I think it does, it says, it's again, it's systemic racism. It says, let's look at healthcare and the Black community and the Hispanic community and where healthcare has been for the last, well, hundreds of years
mm-hmm.
for minority communities, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think people want to, I think that's too almost scary of a topic to talk about. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I think that's just like, it plunges a knife into the heart of white America to say that this is something that's mostly going to affect minority communities.
Mm-hmm.
Into the white narrative, right? That everything's fine, everything's equal, all lives matter. Well, that's just nonsense right now.
Well, it's eye-opening all the way around, and it's like insanely crazy. It has stirred a lot of conversations, which I think is positive. However, we need to get to a point where leaders emerge and we come to some forward-thinking changes as opposed to just showing our righteous indignation out in the streets, you know, because that happened in the 70s, the 60s, and that happened in the, you know, 30s, 40s, and little changes have happened, but if we want to really affect a positive change, we've got to do more than just, you know, lip service to it. In my degree, it's really important. Now, in your book, you talk about the three principles of kindness, and I think that would kind of dovetail into what we're talking about. What are they, and how can we use them?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think on a personal level, because I think sometimes we feel so disempowered as individuals. There's this old African saying that when elephants dance, the grass suffers. And I think a lot of us as individuals are in that position of the grass. We just think this is so big, so huge. The politics seem so complicated, and we don't know what to do. How can I make a difference, right? So I think, and what firefighting, being around great firefighters has taught me that it is about being kind. And that firefighters are remembered more for their kindness than their big red trucks. We have the saying that for every act of bravery, there are 100 opportunities to be kind, right? And so we came up with this idea of radical kindness. So what radical kindness is that daily I seek out opportunities to be kind. I'm proactive about it. And it's little things. When we were outside with each other more, it was opening the door for people. It was letting people cut in front of me in traffic. Now, when we're more homebound, it's calling people and checking in on them, right? Asking how you're doing. All those simple things that really make a difference on a personal level. So it's being proactive about being kind. I think the second principle is don't expect reciprocity. Understand that everybody has a story. Everybody is in pain at some level, right? And when I open the door for someone and they don't immediately thank me for my incredibly, you know, grand gesture of opening the door for them, don't get upset by that. It's not about them. It's about who I want to be in the world. And I want to be thought of as a person of kindness. And the third thing is that don't expect reciprocity from the universe, right? My job is to be kind. The universe is an implacable place. It's a complicated, confusing place that we're not in control of, right? All I'm in control of is what I do, how I think, my attitude, and who I want to be in the world. So don't expect reciprocity from the universe. Just focus on what you can do. And right now, especially right now, when people are so tense, they're so upset. You know, I don't know if you're like me, but I'm so sick of seeing the Karen videos, right? And I look at them two ways. I mean, it's in a lot of times inexcusable behavior, but you say, what's behind that behavior? And it's fear, right? It's fear. People are scared, and they're scared on a multiple levels. They're scared of the virus. They're scared of their lives being disrupted, right? The idea of a mask represents all that fear. I think in kind of the majority culture, or the, you know, temporarily the majority culture, they're afraid of how the country's changing around them, right? And they're terrified. And I think the we need to understand that in our daily interactions. So when that person crowds up to you in a grocery store, right, gets too close to you now, instead of getting mad, we can be kind. right? We can be kind. We can step away. Those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Instead of coming at them with anger, but come at them with kindness first.
Okay, well, I want to talk a little bit more about the Karen videos, because the ones that I've seen have not been many, but the ones that I've seen, I mean, it's a person who's completely outraged, enraged about what's going on. And the one that comes to mind is the young man, I believe he was in Central Park, black young man, bird watcher, who was a Harvard graduate, and she just went off the rails. I mean, that happens to black folks on the daily. I mean, you know, those few were you know, videotaped and put out there, but that happens daily. And sometimes to just let it go is like, you know, I am freaking
I agree.
The other F word, but I'm freaking tired of this happening. So how do we stop that behavior? Because I've learned over the years, it's not about education. I grew up, when I graduated high school, there was three black kids in the graduating class of like 900. Okay, and that was about it for the school. And I got called the N-word on the daily. I mean, if I showed up for school, which I had perfect attendance, I was called the N-word on the daily and more than once. And so where did all, you know, it's like, where did that come from? Because to me, that was old school Karen. You know what I mean?
Yep. I think of it, I think you're absolutely right. And just today or yesterday, three teenage black kids were skateboarding, and a homeless guy threatened them with a knife. I don't know if you saw this. It's a restaurant owner called 911. The police came. What did they do? They pointed rifles and guns at the black kids. They handcuffed the black kids, put them down on the ground, right? And so I think I'm coming at this from a white perspective. Mm-hmm. We have to say that's unacceptable. Right? We have to call it out when we see it. Right? We have to be consciously, we have to be aware of the racist narrative that runs through our heads. Right? Mm-hmm. Why do I cross the street when a group of black teenagers are coming my way? Why? Right? What is going on? Right? So we have to raise that level of consciousness in ourselves. And we can't accept it. And I think there's two things. We can't accept it at a personal level. We can't walk away from it. We can't not see it. Right? We can't not think it. So that's at the personal level. At a societal level, we have to demand. And part of it is, you know, at one level, we have these two old white guys running for president, right? And I'm sick of that. Right? I'm just sick of that. And so at a political level, we have to say, that this is the most important issue in our country, right? It is it's the original sin of America, and the original sin lives on, and we have to step up as individuals in a collective and say, we are responsible for this. It is not the responsibility of minorities to fix this. It's our responsibility, and we have to constantly pound the narrative, the racist narrative, of all lives matter, and that it's some sort of a sociological problem with black folks. That's just bullshit. It's a white problem, and we have to take responsibility for that. And that has to show up in our politics. That has to show up in how we show up as individuals every day. And we have to understand that the pandemic's going to pass, the recession's going to pass, but now is the time. Now is the time, right, for us to say enough. And I get frustrated. I get hopeless because, I grew up in the 60s, right?
Me too.
And I grew up, and I know the status quo is powerful. It is so powerful, right? We just have to, as individuals and the collective, say, this is our problem. This is not something we can, who said, I was reading Thomas Paine and Common Sense, and he said, he's talking about the war. He said, I hate war. But if trouble is to come, let it come now so that my children can live in peace.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that kind of activates me right now. Because I have granddaughters, I have nephews and nieces and grandbabies, and I want them to live in a world differently than ours. So I said that, you know, I've gone from like a conservative Republican when I was a teenager, mostly because I was dating a girl who's a Republican.
That'll do it.
Yeah, that'll do it. But I've become, and I've always been kind of a moderate Democrat, but I'm so radicalized now, right, that this is, we need collective work, right? And so it's hard sitting at home and you can't do anything, but I can write and I can write and I can write, and that's kind of my task going forward.
Okay, very well said. Could you define what it means to be useful and how we can apply that to our daily lives? Because I think based on everything that you said, it does come down to a certain sense of being, you know, useful. What is useful today as opposed to what do I want today?
Right. And let's start with the idea of what it means, what it feels like to be useless, right?
Okay.
And I think, and there's a lot of that going on right now. We talk about, in our country, deaths of despair, that mm-hmm. there's an increasing suicide rate. There's an increasing drug use, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which has got everybody's attention. Why does it have everybody's attention? Because it's happening to white people. Right?
Exactly, because when it was in the ghetto, nobody cared. You know?
Nobody cared. Nobody mm-hmm. cared, right? So it's. But the fact is that it's happening, and part of it is, I think a lot of it is, the sense of being useless, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the most powerful, and this is where people misunderstand. I think that people work for money and to support themselves, and of course they have to do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, but there's a deeper need, and that need is to be useful, to be doing something that's important. We're not here to work in a factory 9 to 5, doing the same repetitive job every day, right? No matter, you know, the school system was invented not to bring creative thinkers to the world, but to create factory workers. Be here on time, do what the teacher says, right? When the bell rings, you get a break. Well, that was designed to train people to go into factories.
Mm-hmm.
And now that's all falling apart, right? And we're here, human beings are these incredibly creative, flexible, versatile, resilient beings, right? And we're here to do important work. And when we're not doing important work, when we're just a cog in the machine, when we have that sense of uselessness, right, that is a recipe for disaster. So how do we be useful, right? And I think it's two things. I'm absolutely, absolutely understand that that we have to make a living, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the how the game is played right now.
Mm-hmm.
We have to make a living. So, but we also have to be useful and have a purpose in our lives. So, I think of it two ways. Either you find work that is your purposing work, your purpose in life, right? We find that.
Mm-hmm.
And we devote our lives to that. And there's a lot of that going on. Or we figure out a way in our non-work life to be useful, to be doing something important, to be doing something that serves others. I think of being useful as taking my talents, what I'm good at, what comes naturally to me, that's easy, and taking that and using that in service making the world a better place. If that's just my community, or if that's on a larger scale, I think those are the kind. That's what being useful is. Being a firefighter and being a volunteer firefighter has taught me that I think the most significant feeling and experience you can have is being useful, is being helping somebody else, is going out on a call, putting a fire out, helping somebody, digging somebody out of the snow, which is the kind of call we get all the time. Those mm-hmm. things, when you have that experience being useful, it's something you crave. It's something you want more of. And you go back to the real world and you have a job where you're doing paperwork and you go, why am I doing this, right? The difference between the experience of being useful as a firefighter and then comparing it to stuff that is not necessarily useful for yourself, you don't feel useful, you don't feel like you're adding something, is a pretty significant difference. And it affects people in different ways.
Okay, very well said. Well, you know, Hirsch, we're at the end of our time. I've thoroughly enjoyed speaking with you today.
Folks, me too.
We've been speaking with Hirsch Wilson. The book is Firefighter Zen, A Field Guide to Thriving in Tough Times. If you've enjoyed what you heard today, you will enjoy the book even more because he really breaks it down to their granular level, but very clearly, very succinctly, and reader-friendly. Again, if you're a slow reader, it'll take you a day and a half to read the book, but get it because it will help you during this very interesting time of transformation. So Hirsch, thank you for being my guest, and the audience, thank you for being with us today as we collectively get over it. And I want you guys to remember that the most important choice that you can make is what you choose to make important. Consider making the masterful choice of living each day fully, but the blessings, light, and love to all. Agape.